We've been wandering around the house these past few weeks, connecting to different places around the home, different rooms, and owning the emotional associations they have for us, meeting Jesus there all along the way. As we close out this last 2 weeks, I want to remind you that what we preach here and what we are doing together as a community is in no way to substitute making sure that you are getting counseling and therapy and medication that you need. We are believers in that. We believe that God uses this space and uses all spaces to help humanity be the best that it can be. So make sure you're making your appointments. We're at the front door. First week, we talked about anxiety and promise. 2 weeks ago, Pastor Raywin shared the bedroom, and we talked about depression and comfort. Last week, we were in the restroom together, the bathroom, and we talked about image and clarity. Today, we are in the kitchen. The kitchen, where we will talk about loneliness. We'll talk about loneliness. The kitchen is one of these places that so much energy happens and takes place there. People are there, they process food together, they're creating together, they eat together, they laugh together, they're living life together in the kitchen. The kitchen is that, oh my goodness. You could tell I don't work in the kitchen very often. Somebody should have told me, y'all. It's embarrassing. The kitchen's that place where we live a lot of life together. And things happen there where we share in meals and memories and laughter. But also places and spaces that have that kind of energy also creates the potential for triggering us of being lonely. It's the spaces that often gather the most people when we are there that can feel oftentimes the loneliest. Today, we want to talk about loneliness. According to the American Psychological Association, loneliness is defined as follows: affective and cognitive discomfort or uneasiness from being or perceiving oneself to be alone or otherwise solitary. Love this. I love this definition because it moves beyond and it's broader than just the idea that if I'm by myself, I feel lonely. There is this idea of perceiving or recognizing that we are alone even in spaces where there are people because we feel a sense of aloneness or solitariness. There's this cognitive discomfort in us. So it doesn't have to be a place that is physically us just by ourselves. This can happen in places with people and crowds where we begin to perceive that, something here is not right and I feel left out. The definition is indeed broader. It recognizes that the feeling of no one is with me can happen whether I'm with or without people. That our perceptions about ourselves and the feeling of being unseen, not valued or understood, creates a sense of loneliness. So here's a couple statistics about loneliness. In fact, the Surgeon General has deemed loneliness to be a pandemic. Approximately half of the United States adults experience loneliness. One out of two. In this room, half of us experience loneliness. That's a large number. When have you felt lonely? In what moments and what places have you felt that sense of loneliness? The World Health Organization points out that one in six people worldwide experience loneliness. Loneliness is associated with high risk factors. It's associated with heart disease and stroke and dementia, depression, anxiety. Loneliness can cause a lot of trauma in our lives. They've said that it's comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Yeah. 15 cigarettes. And I don't know what that's like. I don't smoke cigarettes, but it's got to be not good for you. This week, I asked some of my bright students from the Christian Beliefs course, 245, that I teach this quarter, to write me a journal, and then we closed out our class. I pitched them three questions. Number one, when do you feel most lonely? What makes a church perpetuate loneliness? And when does the church feel safe? For the first question, this was the basic idea from almost all the students. When I am unvalued or not seen, when I'm unvalued, some of them would put it into their experience. When I have friends who, after they're with me, they go out with other people and seem happier with them than they are with me. Some of them would put it in the sense of when I'm around people and they tend to laugh at me, not with me. But it is this idea that you and I, or they, feel most lonely when they are unvalued or not seen. Have you been there? Have you been around a circle of people and they start laughing about a joke and you have no idea what they're laughing about? So you just start laughing along. But you in your mind know, I don't know what they're doing. Maybe you've been in a situation where they're talking about things. Maybe they've turned the conversation and they're talking about me now. In those moments, when I am devalued, it can feel very lonely in that room. So then we ask, what makes a church perpetuate that loneliness? When do you, if you go to a church, what makes it feel this way? These were the two clear answers. When we come to a church, when we go to these churches and people judge us, when we feel judged, and when we come to a place and no one says hello to us, or we come to a place and everyone knows each other but aren't willing to say hi to us, it's not very welcoming. They don't seem like a warm group of human beings. Then the follow-up third question was, when does the church feel safe? And this was the response to a judgmental church. It was almost a correlation here where they said, we don't want a judgmental church, but a church that would make us feel not lonely is a welcoming church. So it wasn't a judgmental church is bad, a non-judgmental church is good. It was a judgmental church group people are bad, but a people who are welcoming makes me feel belonged. A place that's loving, people that are authentic, that are transparent, that tell the truth. As I was reading these, I kept thinking to myself, wow, man, that's really beautiful. I appreciated their transparency. I appreciated their ability to share. And it reminded me that in every space we're in, people deal with loneliness. It is indeed an epidemic. So I want to deal with two things today, two issues. Maybe there are misconceptions. We'll call them misconceptions today, two of them. The first one is this. Being alone is not loneliness. Let's get that cleared out. Being alone is not loneliness. Parents understand this very well. Because after a long day of doing all the things you do, and then having to work extra amounts of long-suffering and patience and teaching and growing and loving and hugging, some alone time is very needed. Parents say amen. Yeah, see how tired they sound? Yes, alone time is not necessarily loneliness. Just because we're alone doesn't mean we're lonely. And just because we're lonely doesn't mean that we're always alone. We can experience loneliness even in the midst of crowds. In the Bible, we notice that Jesus, in key moments, decidedly spent time alone. In Mark chapter 1, he goes to be with his father early in the morning. He goes to be alone with his father. In Luke chapter 5, we see him after the news has spread all the more. Jesus decides to go and be alone. To be alone is a good thing. It helps to build our character. And if you're the kind of person who does not like to be alone, I want to encourage you, take time to be alone. Henry Nouwen writes this: solitude is the furnace of transformation. Without solitude, we remain victims of our society and continue to be entangled in the illusions of the false self. Without taking time to stop and wrestling and being still and finding a deeper voice in us, we become victims of the voices that's all around us, the ones that are constantly speaking into our space, the ones that are trying to move our loyalties and our faithfulness towards them, whether it's a product or a politician, whether it's an organization or a church. Some voice is always trying to move us. And so Nouwen makes the declaration that it is imperative for you and I to take time to be alone, that we might be able to be transformed into the likeness of Christ. Jesus took time to be alone. Being alone is an important part of our growth and maturing. So being alone is not the same as loneliness. Though there are times when being too alone can begin to feel lonely. Adversely, being lonely can happen not just when you're alone. It can happen in all kinds of spaces with all kinds of people. Sometimes it happens in spaces with strangers. Sometimes it happens in the space with classmates, coworkers, and even family members. In those spaces, there are times when we feel lonely. Joseph is a great example of that. Joseph in chapter 37, the word says, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph amongst his brothers was lonely. And in fact, when they sold him and he began to move on his journey alone, we see that he grows the most. We recognize that he begins to land in one place and he grows there in Potiphar's house. And then he gets demoted and goes through things and he lands in prison. But then he grows there again. Even in his aloneness, he creates healthy conditions and connections and environments and friends that helps him grow. It isn't until the end of the story when he is again faced with his brothers that we recognize he begins to fight and wrestle with those emotional demons inside, until he is finding his solid place. Being around brothers, families, coworkers, some friends can feel awfully lonely. The second misconception is that people who need people are weak. This is a misconception. People who need people are weak people. We live in a world that prioritizes radical individualism. Independence is the name of the game in this society that we live in. We celebrate it. We want it. We want to make sure that we can accomplish all the things that we want to accomplish. And we did it our way. Frank Sinatra sang the song of many of our hearts when he said, I did it my way. I am the one who accomplished this. I did it all on my own. I don't need anything. I can do this thing. And then when we do it, we like to proclaim, I did it. I did it. In a world that is very independent, we tend to look down on people when they ask for help. Many of us here, many of you, are better at helping someone else than asking help for yourself. Somebody calls you, oh, I got you. I'm gonna come over with my truck, I'll pick it up. Oh, you need that? No problem. But the minute we need help, it's a bit of a struggle for us to say, hey, someone, I need help, please. Because we lose independence when we ask for help. And in this society, independence is queen. It's the top of the notch. Book of Revelation, in our passage today. The problem with Laodicea. I am rich, I have prospered, I need nothing. You do not realize, Jesus says to them through John, that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. There's an ancient truth in this that we all still struggle with as human beings today. That is that there is a false sense of security we all desire. Oh, if we could just be rich enough, wealthy enough, if we could just prosper enough, if we could just do enough things, if we could just accomplish enough, then we won't need anything. And that will bring us happiness. And we see it here. This was the crux of the problem from Laodicea. They did have these things, and still they were empty. Still, they were lonely. Still, they were left wanting. All the goals in life that you could want to have, go ahead and think of it right now. Take a moment and think about, what is your number one goal right now? Think of it. Give you 5 seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, share it with the person next to you. What's your goal? What goal do you have? Share. Interesting to hear the goals, right? Like, what is your goal? What if our goal in life was the peace that passes all understanding? What if it was the joy that the world could not give? What if our goals in life were to be more like Christ? But in actuality, all the things we watch makes us want to be more like others. There's your favorite sports person. There's your favorite business person. There's your favorite millionaire mogul. There's your favorite this and your favorite that. There's your and we hear all these things, and then we begin to form our lives around the idea that if I just look like, do like, have as much as this person, or even a little bit of that, somehow that will bring me a sense of peace. If I can just accomplish this, I will finally be happy. And so we begin to sacrifice relationships and friendships and inconvenient people that take up too much of our time so that we can reach this goal. Revelation says Laodicea reached that goal and they were still empty. What goals are you running after that when you get there, you're gonna realize, wow, I'm still not happy. I wish it were wealth, because I think wealth is easy enough for us to try to get. But if it were wealth, billionaires wouldn't want any more. If it was wealth, one car would have been enough. If it was wealth, the house that we have now would have made us happy and content. But sometimes I find myself saying, man, if we just, hey, you know, we drive through our neighborhood and then we see these homes and then it says, hey, open house, come in. And we go in and I said, man, if we could just move to this house, look at the painting on the wall, the pool in the back, this would make me happy. And I was thinking about that most recently because I was visiting a house in our neighborhood and I was like, ooh, wow. And the words that came out of my mouth is, this house is just like ours, except better. Same layout, but way nicer. And I'm getting my car to go home. I drive up to our house and I see the big tree. And I'm reminded, growing up, we used to take care of these homes. We were the ones mowing the lawn for these homes. We were keeping the upkeep. We were cutting the trees and the bushes. And when I look at this home growing up in our family's home, I'd always think to myself, one day, if I could ever have a home like this one, I would just thank God for what he gives me. What goals? What goals do we think we need that we sacrifice relationships, that we give up on inconvenient friendships because we are on the way to being radically independent? So, because we do, we tend to discount people who need help from other people. But in actuality, that is exactly how God created us to be. We like to be self-enclosed, and we think that if we do this, it'll somehow fulfill our souls. And this gets complicated by social media and devices. It gets very complex with it, because especially if you're not the extrovert, you're our wonderful, thoughtful introverts, when we get uncomfortable, let's be honest, we all get on a phone. That's what we do. It's normal for us. Like, if you don't know what the answer is and they're not talking to you, you pull that phone up and I'm just going to be here. We don't realize every time we do that, it's formation, right? So we're forming ourselves in this way that the best thing for me to do when I get uncomfortable is to what? Pull up my phone. A few years ago, we used to live in Long Beach in a high rise. We were in the 17th story. And I would ride the elevator up and down as per usual. And I had a neighbor, and all the other neighbors and I were really close and good friends. This neighbor, she just didn't like me very much. I don't know why. I'm not sure. You know, she was a little bit older, and maybe, I don't know, maybe she was annoyed by how loud and rambunctious we could be. I'm not sure. And every time I'd get into the elevator, she would move to the corner and pull out her phone. Every time. Then I had to ride 17 stories with me awkwardly standing next to this person who's in the corner with her phone. She didn't do that when my wife got in the elevator. When my wife gets in, oh, really? I got into the elevator one day and she was in there. She moved right to the corner, was on her phone. And I was like, not today, sister. Not today. So I went over there and stood with her in the corner. And looking at her phone, and I just, hey, how are you? And she was like, hi. What are you doing? I said, we've been riding this elevator together for a while, and you seem to always be busy on your phone. I wanted to come over and say hello to you. And she says, okay, hello. She says, do you want to look at my screen? I said, no. I just want to say hello and see your eyes. You have beautiful eyes. Then I walked to my corner and I stood there. I did that from that point forward until it got to the point when she would get in the elevator, she'd see me, she'd walk over and stand next to me. I'm like, how are you doing? She's like, I'm good. Have you seen our neighbor? They're super annoying. Oh, yeah, you're right, they're loud. I didn't want to tell her that now he was coming out of my house. Yeah. Friendships, the boldness to slow down and decide to look into another person's eyes and talk and share. Social media and devices, they've locked us up. We've created a formation for ourselves that when it gets awkward or when we don't have the answers or, you know, we just get on that phone, just get on that device. Then you won't have to deal with people. And I get it because I'm that way on planes. I don't like talking to people. They never make the plane seats large enough. So I'm sitting real close with that other person. They always want to ask what you do. I hate telling people I'm a pastor because, you know, for the rest of that flight, they're gonna be telling me about their life that I didn't ask about. It's tough, right? What it's like when we sit in these moments together and be curious and discover and hear. So we live these parasocial lives where we know a lot about people that we don't actually live life with. We go to appointments, sit around a table with those who've invested time to be there, only to push like buttons with people thousands of miles away that we don't know. And we have confused connection. We think that this is connection. We don't make time as much anymore to actually connect. So the loneliness pandemic continues to grow. The loneliness pandemic continues to roll on. We get too caught up. We get too flustered. We get too into ourselves and into our rhythm. Laodicea was convinced that they didn't need anything. They had gotten all that they had, and that's all that they needed. Yet they seemed to only be lukewarm. They couldn't quite get to their full potential because they thought they had had everything they needed. Jesus longed for them to be hot or to be cold. Jesus longed for them to have vibrancy and to fill spaces they were in with life, something that was countercultural to the city they lived in. They lived in one of the wealthiest cities in that known time. They had a huge catastrophe, everything fell apart, and they didn't need any money from Rome. They rebuilt themselves. They were a part of a culture that told them, hey, your wealth really matters to your value. And they truly believed that and missed out on the ability to be hot or cold. Oh, for us as a church not to just be comfortable being lukewarm. They couldn't see the deepest desire of needing nothing was blocking them from living life fully. We are created to need each other, not to be islands to ourselves, not to be able to pull ourselves up and say, I did it. No, we were created to be together. Melissa Ballesteros-Williams says it this way: needing people is not a flaw. Needing people is not a flaw. In the book of Genesis, before the Christian account of the fall of Adam and Eve, while still in perfect states, God said this: it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper as his partner. Before even the account of a fall for Adam and Eve, God said it was important for them to not be alone. So the desire for people and connectivity and for help is not a matter of sin and brokenness. It's the way we were created. You and I were created to need each other, to live with each other, to eat with each other, to grow with each other, to teach each other, to hold each other. We were created in this fashion to live a life together, not to be independent, but to be interdependent. So here, this word Adam is not good for man, or Adam in the Hebrew. The word Adam means humanity. Humanity. It is not good for humanity to be alone. We were not designed merely to survive biologically. We were created for communion. This is what Jesus did. Here was the answer to the lukewarmness. Jesus comes and knocks on the door and says, anyone who hears and opens the door, I will come eat with you. To commune together, to live life together, to eat together. Jesus knocks and wants to come in and eat together. These meals meant so much. Jesus did it so often. Religious leaders, let's eat. Sinners, tax collectors, let's eat. Large crowds of 5,000 and beyond, let's eat. Intimate dinner of 12, let's eat. Jesus eats and eats. I feel like a portrait of Jesus should be a little bit thicker than the ones we see. Because Jesus eats a lot. Jesus creates these spaces where the senses are filled with association to comfort and the blood sugars are rising and people begin to relax. Eating in Jesus' day was a way of acceptance, of giving value, of saying you are seen. And so Jesus eats with people. Jesus is not discriminate about who he eats with. He just wants to create a sense of belonging. In his eating, he says, you are valued, you are seen. Jesus didn't tell them to change. He just made sure they were seen. When you ate with someone, you were making a statement that I see you. The solution to loneliness is belonging. And in order to create belonging, we must be able to see each other. Not judge, but to welcome. To invite, to care for. The solution to this loneliness is belonging. But belonging takes some work. It takes intentionality, and it takes trust. So, Jesus longs for us to live abundantly, but that only happens when we're able to create belonging for each other. And as we do that for each other, we begin to find, hey, we belong too. Do we make the spaces we're in safe enough for someone to belong? Even if they don't think like us, even if they don't talk like us, even if they have different ideas, can they feel safe enough to be seen in spaces that we are in? That is the good work we have to do before us. I want to show you a photo. This is a photo of some delicious kitchen work. Look at that. Sourdough bread. I made that. You impressed? I didn't make that. Pastor Elizabeth made this. What Pastor Elizabeth likes to do is she likes to make these beautiful sourdough breads, send us a picture, and let us know that we have not yet tasted it. But we drool and we look at, and I saw this in a text thread she sent out while we were working last week. She sent this beautiful piece of bread, and it struck me early this morning, hey, that's fantastic. So I text Elizabeth. I said, Elizabeth, can you tell me a little bit about how to make sourdough bread since I'm gonna be in the kitchen this Sabbath? And she says, yes. So she begins to break it down for me on how sourdough bread is made. And she gave me just a few points through a text. So I put them together and I threw it on here. Number one, you need a starter. And I'm still not exactly sure what a starter is, but I think it's like a piece of like some kind of sourdough dough of some raw stuff, right? But you need a starter, she says. And then you need to feed that starter. And if you feed that starter, the culture in that starter begins to change, which is what you want. So you've got to have a starter and then you've got to feed it. You've got to be intentional about the starter. And then as the big thing the culture begins to change in it, if it's warm, that dough will grow. So you see here, it started like this and she fed it and then it begins to grow and thicken and gets larger and larger. And then she says, this process takes about 24 hours from when you start to when you make the bread. And that's when I checked out. Because I can go to Stater Brothers. Somebody say amen. Go ahead and pick me up a sourdough loaf right there, you know. Pay my $50. Bring that puppy home and eat it immediately. Does it taste the same? No. Of course it doesn't taste the same. That thing's been sitting on the shelf for who knows how long. I don't know how sour the dough actually is in that sourdough. You want good sourdough. You got to make that stuff. If you got to make that stuff, you've got to wait for that stuff. So now you got to have a starter. And once you have that starter, you got to feed that thing. You got to be intentional about taking care of that thing. And as you do, you're just going to have to be patient with it. And as you're being patient with it and you wait for it, it will take time. Trust the process. But if you trust the process, if you let it be in warm places, if you're intentional about letting it grow, then you will have a beautiful product at the end of the journey. This is a picture of Elizabeth's first sourdough loaf. I still have not tasted it yet. And I thought about this. If we want to be a place of belonging, of care, it's going to take work. Friends, it doesn't come just in neutral spaces. We've got to be intentional about this. So first, there's a starter. You've got to decide to go for it. You've got to trust that you can open up and let people in. And it doesn't have to be a huge trust. Just use a little trust. Open up a little bit. Try it out. And in that space, if you let that be your starter, something will already begin to grow. And then, as you start to find these opportunities and these spaces where you can get into the rhythm, you gotta be intentional. Don't stop. It's gonna feel awkward. Don't get on your phone. Turn to somebody and say, don't get on your phone. Tell somebody else, don't get on your phone. It's gonna get hard, right? And then someone's gonna ask you a weird or random or like weird question and you're like, it's time for the phone. Don't do it. Be intentional. You gotta let this culture change. And it can only happen if you are willing to process it through. Feed it. Some of us, it's easy. The extroverts, easy. Y'all do this all day long. For introverts, you know, it's gonna take a little bit of, but listen, we all don't have to go to big spaces. Find one or two people. Hold beautiful, authentic, transparent conversation. Trust it. Trust the process. And then be patient with yourself. We all won't lose that experience of loneliness overnight. But if you're patient with the process, if you trust it a little bit at a time, if you make a connection here and there, you'll know that with that patience comes a beautiful product. Trust your process. I want to give you three things as we close today. Here's our three challenges for the week. Number one, trust. Open up and share yourself with someone. It didn't have to be the whole door. As some of you all overshare too much. Slow down. Just share a little bit. But trust. Trust the process. Be real. Let yourself be seen. Too often we're running from being seen, and because we're not willing to be seen, people don't know how to relate to us, and then we interpret that as they don't want us around. Or we try to fool them. We try to impress them into liking us. So we tell them about our accolades and we talk about our ability to play a sport or how good our grades are, my car, or my look at my occupation, and we get lost in all of the stuff that people don't want to know about us, that it's hard for us to show them ourselves. Let people see you a little bit. Let yourself be known. Work on trusting people. You may have been hurt sometime in your journey. It may be really difficult to trust another human being. But if you want belonging, you will have to be vulnerable enough to trust, even if it's just a little bit. So trust, number one. Number two, I want to invite you to take someone out to eat this week. Go get some coffee. Go eat a sandwich. Maybe pizza. Think of someone right now. Think of who that person might be for you. And I want you to invite them out and go eat. Turn to the person next to you and say, hey, let's go eat. Turn to the person behind you. Say, hey, let's go eat. Hey, let's go eat. That's just practice for the person who you're going to ask this week to go eat with. See? It's not that hard, right? Invite someone out to go eat. Spend some time. You don't have to tell them your whole life story. That might be scary for you or them. Take them out. And when you take them out to eat, don't pull your phone out. Don't do it. Set it on silent, flip it upside down, leave it in your bag, leave it in the car. Because you and I know the temptation is, if there's any room to breathe, we're gonna look at our phones. Put it down and put it away. Finally, you're asking yourself, man, I need a starter. Where do I start? What is my starter gonna be if I'm gonna try to start getting out of my loneliness rhythm, right? Because sometimes, if we're honest, we say things like, man, I just don't feel like I connected that place. You know, there's just nothing for me there. And then on our way out, four people have invited us to lunch and someone has told us, hey, we've got a choir that you should join on Friday. And someone else says, hey, we could use your help on the at the food bank on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And someone else says, hey, it was great meeting you. Will you want to come for lunch? And we're just like, no, thank you. And we get outside and we're like, there's just no place for me here. I'm gonna give you a starter right now. Here's a good one, okay? The 29th, Friday evening, I wanna invite you to Open Table. I went on to check before I just came up here and people have already been signing up. I wanna invite you, come, sign up. Jump in. We're doing this beautiful thing, not just for ourselves, not because we wanna go eat, which we do like, the pastors like to go eat, so we will go, but not just for ourselves. We recognize how important it is for us to spend time together, to fellowship, to hold conversation, to be present with each other, to hear each other's story, share each other's story, and be seen. Because as we do that kind of rhythm, there's a belonging that comes with it. And guess what? When you feel seen and you belong, loneliness begins to dissipate. Let's do this together. Here is your beautiful starter. Make a choice and go for it. I don't know whose house. I don't know these people. Don't worry, we'll be there. Pastor Ben's at one house and Pastor Raywin's at another house. Pastor Devo is gonna be at the Powell's house. Pastor Elizabeth is at the Hemingway, Stephen Sada's house. We'll all be all over the place. There'll be people who will welcome you there. These hosts open their homes just for you. So go to that place. Lock in. Get a connection. I'd love to see us continue to grow together. I'd love to see loneliness in our third space dissipate. I'd love for our students at the university, when they come in here, can write in their journals, yo, those people, they are welcoming. They are aggressively welcoming. They might almost be too welcoming. I'd love for them to feel this place as a place where they could belong to, because the formation that they will get here will help them become the best they can be in the rest of this world. And so, let's start here together. Here's your starter. Go ahead and click on that bad boy. And on Friday night, I hope to see you at one of these homes. Maybe it's the home I'm at. Maybe it's the home Pastor Raywin's at. But we would love to have you there. Let's squash loneliness in this community. We can do this together. Be well.